Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eid, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Keala C. Eid presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is Keala Eid. I am the presiding judge today. Today is June 6, 2024. I am joined by Chief Judge Susan Siegel and Judge Jeannie Cochran. We have three cases on our oral argument calendar today. The first case is A23-1385, Twin City Underwriters, Inc. Respondent versus Heppner Insurance Agency, LLC, et al. Appellants. Before we start with argument, a couple housekeeping matters. There is a switch on the front of the podium for you to adjust to your preferred height. There is a recording being made of today's proceedings that will be available on our website later this afternoon or tomorrow at the latest. That is the only official recording that is to be made, or only recording that is to be made of these proceedings. We do live stream on Zoom. There's no recording of our live stream. Failure to comply with the court rules could subject a party or a member of the public to contempt proceedings or other sanction. When you start your argument, please identify yourself and how you'd like us to refer to you so that we have a record of that. And counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. With that, counsel, when you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. We have an appeal from a jury trial verdict in this instance. We had subsequent motion practice after the jury trial was completed.
Can I pause you 1 second?
Sure.
We'll pause the time. Will you just identify your name for the
record? I'm sorry, Matthew Scott, for appellants.
Okay, thank you.
So we come to this court, which is an error-correcting court, following a jury trial, where there was a lot of discussion about some of the jury instructions relating to things like civil theft. I mean, theft by swindle, I'm sorry, which relates to civil theft. So it's a statute, but in this case, the jury instructions were kind of tweaked and modified in ways that made them into a theft by swindle civil theft claim, which, as far as I can tell in the case law, doesn't exist up to this point. It should not have been given as a jury instruction, but it was given.
Are you talking, what specifically are you talking about? Which instruction? You could just be very specific.
The theft by swindle jury instruction relating to civil theft.
So where in your brief do you raise this argument?
Your Honor, we raised this argument throughout the brief relating to the civil theft and the theft by swindle not applying to a non-personal property right, which is the right that they were essentially saying these customers represented. There was no personal property, and there was no evidence that it was taken surreptitiously. We've briefed those issues as to the theft by swindle jury instruction. It should not have been given because of the facts of this case. There was no argument that there was a property right that was stolen by the defendants.
Was there an objection to that before the district court? I mean, I'm not following this argument based on the briefing to this court.
There were multiple objections. We've cited to those in the record in both the initial principal brief and the reply brief. So, Your Honors, we objected to the jury instruction, and then after this trial was over, the jury awarded a verdict against H&HIG and against Laurel Heppner, but after finding that there was essentially a liability for HIA and Ronald Heppner, there were zero damages awarded. And that in Minnesota, in every one of the claims that was pursued, damages is an element of the claim. So when that zero damage award came back from the jury, the judge was obligated to enter judgment in favor of the defendants who received that defense verdict.
So, and I follow that argument. So what you're asking for, and this would be the result, is that we would direct the district court to then enter judgment in favor of TCU against your client on your client's counterclaim, correct?
No,
because the exact same language is in the order for judgment.
We would ask the court to, the jury finding was that there was a zero damages award in favor of TCU.
Correct, so judgment should be entered in favor of your, well, two of your clients, I guess, where zero was awarded. But the district court judge used the exact same language with respect to your counterclaim, that judgment not be entered in favor of your clients on the counterclaim. So was that in error also then? So that judgment should be entered in favor of TCU on the counterclaim?
That issue is not before the court. So that issue was not appealed. It wasn't brought as part of a cross appeal by the other side. This court is only reviewing the issues that are
before
it. But
is that the same error?
If a...
Setting aside, you know, whether it's in front of us or not.
I would say that a district court is obligated to enter judgment in favor of the prevailing party on that claim. So judgment should have been entered in favor of HIA and Ronald Heppner on the claims against them by TCU as a matter of law. It strikes me as one of the most...
Along that logic, then, on your client's counterclaim, judgment should have been entered in favor of respondent.
Judgment of dismissal.
And I understand your argument that it hasn't, that it's not in front of us.
That in general is how the rules read.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the discretionary component of it is whether a court decides who's the prevailing party.
Right.
Here the court did not do that. It didn't engage in any analysis. It just said there is no winner. That was kind of the gist of the final order. And we asked the court to correct it. The court did not correct it, and now it's here before this court.
What's the prejudice? Oh, go ahead.
Assuming we agree with you or that you're correct regarding the law, how are your two clients that are HIA and Ronald Heppner, how are they prejudiced by the lack of judgment being entered?
Because of the judgment not being entered in favor of my clients, they were not allowed to seek prevailing party costs and disbursements. When you get brought into a lawsuit, you spend years in the lawsuit, and then a jury finds a zero verdict in favor of the other side. The other side loses, you win, and under Minnesota statutes, you're permitted to seek costs and disbursements. Because that judgment was never entered, we were never allowed to take that step. There can oftentimes, when there are multiple parties, there can be splitting of the relief. One party might prevail, a co-defendant might not. And so this court has to look at each individual party, look at who is a winner, who is a loser. If there are any fact findings that need to go into this analysis, it can go back to the district court. But as a matter of law, the district court erred by not doing what it needed to do in entering judgment on the verdict form. Now, I see that there's a lot of preference for juries. I've known that. I've been practicing for 20 years. But when a jury does something that is maybe confusing to the district court, fact-finding, the district court still has the ultimate obligation to reach a legal conclusion based on the facts found by the jury. And here that legal conclusion was that two parties should have been had judgment entered in their favor, and that didn't happen. I also want to get to the other issues that we've briefed, Your Honors. I want to focus on the attorney's fees. So this is kind of a unique case. I've been to lots of CLEs where everyone says, well, since United Prairie, no one tries juries fees to the jury. They all figure it out before the trial. This is one of the unique cases where fees were tried to a jury. And this case allows this court to take a careful look at how fees were tried to this jury. They were tried through an expert witness who was a trial attorney for the TCU. He signed the summons and complaint. His name was on the motion in limine. In this case, at the last minute, without disclosing this individual as an expert, he came in and testified as an expert. He opined that the fees were reasonable at the last minute without previously being disclosed. That's a problem in this case. What's also a problem is this suggestion in the case law that you don't need an expert to try fees to a jury. A lot of people would argue, or this seems to be a theme throughout the case law, that you can come in as the client and say, I paid the bill, and therefore the bill is due. But that doesn't mean the bill was reasonable, and unless you have expert testimony and proper expert testimony disclosed properly before the trial, it leaves
the... What would make that not accessible to a jury to figure out, though? Because you only need expert testimony when it's outside the, you know, a jury couldn't understand it. And the jury instructions here set out the lodestar factors, and there was, you know, testimony. And I understand your argument about that this he should have been disclosed as an expert because he was testifying about, you know, from his knowledge and experience as a lawyer. But why is that not within the province of a jury, particularly since your clients were the one who insisted on submitting that to the jury, right? Kind of at the last minute?
I don't think there's any last minute anything. We asked for a jury trial. The suggestion has been this was a last minute thing, but United Prairie has been in place since 2016, and the presumption is that if you go after contract-based attorney's fees, you're going to the jury with those. Here, the jury certainly could have been and should have been instructed, but attorney's fees are not as straightforward as maybe we as practitioners might think. If I bill a block bill and I spend 10 hours working on a motion, the jury doesn't know what kind of motion that is. It doesn't have any sense of whether that's reasonable, whether I should have billed 1 hour or 10 or even 20. Where experts come into the case law, and the case law is pretty persuasive in this regard, that a jury needs help understanding an attorney's bill. They can't just assess for themselves that this is a reasonable charge and this is not a reasonable charge.
So
this is a rare case.
What's your best case to cite? I mean, which is the most helpful to you on that issue? Because I didn't see any cases saying it requires expert testimony.
And I wouldn't say that's the case. I would say they're persuasive. In regard to the to that issue, Your Honor, I would point the court to the Inree Strid, and then the Denny versus Metro Medical Center cases, and I think the same concept of expert testimony applies regardless of whether you're talking about medical evidence, you're talking about legal fees. They are confusing. It's confusing to a layperson. You have a jury that doesn't have any sense of whether something's reasonable or not. I think this court can and should set a rule where it looks at this case law where there's been the strong suggestion that expert testimony is required to prove fees or to show fees to the jury.
Is that our rule, to set a new rule? If there's no authority on point as an error correcting court?
There's the SunCom decision. That decision strongly suggests that like a CFO is not qualified to opine as to jury fees or the reasonableness of fees, and that an expert in that instance was indeed required. That's an unreported decision, but it is very persuasive on the question that we have squarely before this court. We've argued throughout this case that a jury needs that assistance from an expert. I want to also address, Your Honors, the lodestar analysis. The respondent's argument in this vein is essentially that if you ask for a jury, you get whatever the jury comes back with, regardless of how outlandish it is, how outrageous it is in relation to the actual award. Here, the success on the merits and the results were not good. The ask was over $3 million, and when it all came back, there was about 2% of that awarded against Laurel Heppner. And Laurel Heppner was the sole recipient of the entire attorney fee award. It was more than three times the rest of the award against Laurel Heppner, so $55,000, and then in excess of three times that amount was awarded as an attorney fee against Laurel Heppner. Zero against HIA, zero against Ronald Heppner, zero against H&HIG. This is completely disproportionate, And I don't think that this court wants to condone, and it should not condone, a rule where a jury can basically ignore Lodestar, ignore the results it just awarded.
Can't we look at it another way? I mean, the jury seems to have done a pretty good job here in saying, wait a minute, we're not going to award what they're asking for, and really taking a hard look at this and awarding really a fraction of what was being requested. So, I mean, how do you respond to that if we look at it the other way and say, wait a minute, they didn't just buy this line from plaintiff. They really looked at this long and hard and made a reasoned judgment.
If you accept that the $55,000 out of $2.6 million that was actually awarded against Ms. Heppner was a well-reasoned decision by this jury, the only other conclusion is that the jury was confused by the lodestar factors and did not apply them properly.
How do we surmise that? Where does that come from? Besides just, because the case law says, yeah, that's a factor to look at, but that's not the only factor, is the disproportionate. And in fact, it comes in less than the total judgment. And we're talking about a married couple that worked in tandem here.
But it wasn't
unreasonable to kind of look at them as a whole.
But when you look at the zero fee award against all of the other parties, and then you look
at all of the other parties.
The fee award.
The fee award, okay.
Yes.
All right.
Against all other parties, but, and then to assign the entire fee award against one party who only was awarded, had a verdict against her of $55,000, that, if we put it in the case law and that becomes the law in Minnesota, it is completely disproportionate. I also don't, and I would caution this court to rubber stamp or condone such an out-of-line verdict, because the jury is who gets these under United Prairie. For those reasons, we ask that the court would grant the relief, and I'll speak again on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Tom Atmore on behalf of the respondent, Twin City Underwriters. So the first issue I want to address is the question of the motions for judgment as a matter of law as to Ronald Heppner and HIA. The jury found in favor of TCU on all elements of the claims made against those two defendants, including causation and damages. What ultimately happened is that on the special verdict form, which is Index 137, which both parties agreed to and was worked out between the parties, the jury was asked at question 59 on page 9 of that verdict form to attribute damages. So they were first asked, are all the elements of the claim met? Yes, 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 yes. What are the damages? $202,000. Last question, who's going to pay?
But with zero, I mean, they did say zero.
They did.
And so damages means something more than zero. So how do we reconcile those two things? Because I know in the special verdict form it said yes to this caused damages.
Right.
But then it caused zero damages. So that seems to be like an element of the claim, and how do we, or is it an irreconcilable verdict? I mean, somebody has to have judgment on each claim, it seems
right.
like.
Right, I think it is not irreconcilable, and it is not inconsistent because of the way that special verdict form was structured and the way the question was asked. And so they were asked, are all the elements here? And they said yes. They were asked, did each party cause damage? Yes. Then they were asked, well, what's the total amount of the damage? And then they're asked, attribute. The word is attribute to the defendants. So they really what they're asked is who's going to pay, not whether or not Ron Heppner caused damage or whether or not HAI caused damage, but who's going to pay now? Who do you want to pay? It's not inconsistent that they would say, well, we want Laurel to pay or we want HNHIG to pay, but we don't want Ron to pay or we don't want HAI to pay. That's not inconsistent.
Your argument is the order for judgment should actually say judgment should be entered in favor of TCU on all claims, and yes?
We're not asking for a change from what the judge actually did. The judge, in response to the motion from the appellants, changed the amended order for judgment to say that there will be no judgment in favor of TCU against HIA and Ron Heppner.
So Mr. Schaap was asked, what difference does this make? Mm-hmm. And so what, I mean, there's a lot of briefing from both sides on this single issue. What difference
would it make
if we agreed with appellants?
I don't think it would make any difference. Now, there was this issue of, well, we can't seek costs or disbursements. In fact, they did, and it was it was rejected, and then that went on to appeal to the district court, and the district court judge said, no, we're not going to give you costs and disbursements. You didn't prevail. You're not the prevailing party. And, you know, really what the judge has to do in this case, if there is no inconsistency, if there's no controversial verdict, is make an order that follows what the jury says and what the jury findings were. And that's exactly what the judge did here. And under Poplar and the other cases we cite, the judge acted appropriately in doing that and really didn't make these supplemental findings that would have changed what the jury actually said in the verdict. Now, they're not arguing inconsistency or some other issue with the verdict. They just want something outside the verdict to be put into the record. And I don't think that can be done under Poplar and the other cases. What the jury decided is binding on the court. And unless you're going to argue inconsistency or unless you're going to argue something else, that says that verdict has to be redone, which they're not doing, the judge has to follow that. And the way this thing was structured and worded, that question 59, there's nothing to change. It's just the way that the verdict came down. They agreed to the special verdict form. And so I think the judge did exactly what the judge was supposed to do. And I don't understand why all the argument about it, only because it wouldn't change anything, because their cost petition was already rejected.
So is there a harmless error ground on which you'd ask us to resolve this claim, that there's no prejudice because of what you just said, that the cost and disbursements issue was already resolved?
I think you could do it that way too, yes. But I think the more important point is that the judge did exactly what the judge has to do under Poplar, and that is follow the verdict.
Don't we have to kind of take a narrow view of Poplar by only finding that the jury's determination as to the elements on damages are binding on the court and not the jury's finding as to the amount that's apportioned to Ronald and
HIA.
HIA.
Yes. How
do we parse that? How do we apply Poplar in one instance and not as to the, I understand what you're saying, that the jury was given this question of how to apportion, but it seems to me that that's, to Chief Judge Siegel's question, how do we reconcile those with Poplar's command that the findings in the special verdict form, which includes zero, are binding?
Well, they are binding, but again, so are the other findings, that there was causation and damage on each claim. And there is no argument that there's inconsistency in this verdict. That's not what they're arguing. What they're arguing is they want something more now. They want a statement that as a matter of law, they were the prevailing party. And that's not what this verdict says. And the judge did exactly what the judge should have done and just said, okay, you're not gonna get judgment against these two parties, but I'm not going to give you something outside what the verdict was. And you're not telling me that there's inconsistency, you're just telling me you want something more. And he couldn't do that on this special verdict form. So I think he did the right thing, and I don't think you need to find an inconsistency because there wasn't one and they haven't argued there's one. I'd like to move on to the question of Laurel Heppner's request for judgment as a matter of law. And again, they did not, as we pointed out in our brief, they didn't make this argument below in the motion for post-trial relief. And so it shouldn't be considered on this appeal. Even if it is considered, there's more than sufficient evidence in the record, including the party's contract, that these clients were TCU clients. And we cite all that evidence in the brief. Similarly, I think they've waived the argument that theft of a client cannot be the basis for a theft by swindle claim. What they said in their brief was, you don't need to worry about this, but we'll bring it up in the reply if we need to. That's a waiver. You have to make that argument in your principal brief. You don't get to hold back and wait for a reply. So again, the evidence, regardless, supports the conclusion that Ms. Heppner intentionally and surreptitiously diverted TCU clients and commissions, not just clients, but clients and commissions that were rightfully TCU's under the agreement. The third point I want to make is that the district court didn't abuse its discretion in allowing into evidence exhibits 46 through 54. These are the summary exhibits that showed the TCU clients and commissions that went to H&HIG. Now, the appellant's argument regarding the supposed high-rise list is essentially that TCU must have had information that the appellants did not, a list.
Can you just clarify something for me with regard to this argument? In appellant's brief, at one point, they say that the exhibits were provided 2 weeks before trial, but in another place, they say 45 days before trial. Can you clarify that for me?
Sure. So
the timing of when the exhibits were provided.
So it's my understanding that it's actually 45 days before trial. The information was provided. And there may have been a summary exhibit that came later, but not the information. In other words, as you head into trial, you prepare summary exhibits. There isn't a deadline where those have to be provided in discovery. Those are for use at trial. So all the information is my understanding. All the information was provided at least 45 days before trial. And that was after we got the late disclosure. We had to bring a motion to compel of the H&HIG list that allowed the damages to be calculated in the first place. And so essentially what they're doing is arguing, hey, you delayed getting us information when it's really their fault. And their fault because they refused to provide any usable format. The second half of the equation, so there are two parts of the damages. TCU's list compared to H&HIG's list, and where you have overlap, that's where you get your damages. We didn't have H&HIG's list in usable form until September of 2022 after a motion to compel them to produce it in usable form. As soon as we got it, then we could start putting the comparisons together, generating the spreadsheets, generating the information. We provided that at least 45 days before trial. As I sit here, I don't recall specifically whether there was another summary exhibit that was 2 weeks before trial or not. But regardless, it wouldn't be a violation of any rule to do it that way because they are summary exhibits. The issue is whether or not the party had the information to begin with.
And the clients or customers that Laura Heppner had sold, that information was produced during the regular, I mean, while she was still under contract with TCU, that was produced in the normal course of discovery.
Right, so what you're talking about is the underlying data,
yes.
Right? And that
yes.
was produced back in January of 2020, long time ago. And the information, these are the commission statements, that information was given to her during the course of working every month. That's how she got paid. You got your commission statement, and it listed your clients, and it listed what you're going to get paid. So they always
copies
had that information.
Those were also produced during discovery. That
oh,
data.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
In January of 2020.
You've already got this. We're not giving it to you.
Yeah.
So everyone had the raw data. It was just a summary exhibit that was the comparison that was created later.
Right. It was spreadsheets that were derived from the data that was provided by HNHIG and provided by TCU. And it came in HiRISE. That's the name of the software program, the contact management program. But that's just a database. And so you can manipulate it and pull the information out. But the underlying raw data, as both Cindy Peterson and Laurel Heppner testified, is the commission lists. That's what you put into HiRISE in order to get the list of names that you can ultimately export from HiRISE onto a spreadsheet. And they always had that.
And is there any dispute over this? There was a lot of discussion about the HiRISE list, and it includes contacts and not just clients. So what's TCU's view of that issue? I mean, were damages awarded for using contacts that were in the HiRISE software?
Well, no. And the answer to that is twofold. So number one, the claim for damages was based on clients who generated a commission. That's what the damage number was from. Not just contacts, it was a client who generated commission. In cross-examination, the appellants, I think, if you look at the award compared to the request, perhaps quite effectively took shots at all that and said, hey, you've got double counting, triple counting, you've got this, you've got a contact that's not a client, et cetera. So the second part of that is there's really no prejudice. They handled it, and the jury didn't appear to go our way on it. If anything, they went defendant's way on it. And so I think that's an attempt to find an issue for appeal that really doesn't exist because, again, they had all the information. They got the disclosure as soon as they provided their half of the equation, and they were able to handle it at trial and make arguments to the jury. I see my time is up. I just want to make one quick statement about the expert witness, if I may. And that is that the SunCom cases are the two cases that really discuss the issue. And the issue wasn't that the CEO in that case was not an expert, and so you can't have a CEO. It was that CEO didn't have the proper foundation. And we had two witnesses that the proper foundation was laid for and who were able to give the testimony as to the reasonableness of the fees. And the appellant acquiesced and agreed to the jury instruction 16, on the jury's determination of the fee award, and they need to be bound by what they requested and what they agreed to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, as to waiver, there was no waiver of this argument that in order to be something that can be stolen, it needs to be tangible property. That issue is addressed in our arguments in the principal brief. It is the focus is on whether it was wrongfully or surreptitiously, but the word personal occurs 16 times in the context of that argument in our briefing. And to suggest that it's not somehow before this court as kind of a gotcha is not something this court should follow.
So what is your argument on that? I followed there's discussion about whether you have to show it's surreptitious or whatever, but what's your argument on that?
So we've argued that when you have a piece of personal property that you're wrongfully in possession of, you can be sued for civil theft. It's a statute in Minnesota, has double damages, things like that. But what you can't be sued for is sort of this inchoate right. Like maybe at some point you'll get a customer to come to your business, and that inchoate, maybe the customer comes, maybe the customer never comes. You can't steal that, and you can't frame it.
Oh, you're talking about the client list.
You can't.
That's all. Okay.
And it's not even the client list. It is the customer relationship that they're saying is stolen. It is this intangible, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't at some point in the future. And that should never have been an instruction. It shouldn't have been given to the jury. And to the extent that played into their decision-making, either as to Ms. Heppner or as to H&HIG, it should have been reversed. The other issue I wanted to address, Your Honor, is this high-rise list. There's so much confusion about this. I think the district court was confused. I just heard counsel, I think probably in good faith, saying that the information was in our client's possession. That is not the case. There's no citation to the record when they claim that. What this was is a Salesforce kind of a functionality. So you have all these contacts. Some of them are customers, some of them are not customers. They then feed that at the last minute before trial, using it without telling us about it, and they create all these spreadsheets. And the spreadsheets are crossed against actual money that came in. So they say this person was on the high-rise list, that person is also in the commission list, therefore that is a damage that we suffered. High-rise goes onto the commission list. But the problem is, there were contacts on that list that were never customers of TCU. They just sat on a computer. They weren't actually owned by or in business with TCU. They might have been an address, it might have been a name. All those people were fed into this commission database.
What about the harmless error, just because your time's running down? Your counterpart's argument is that the jury winnowed that out and didn't award damages in that way.
We don't know that because we don't know what the jury based the award on. When you get $55,000 out of $2.6 million, yes, the jury was skeptical of some of their arguments. I want to address the harmless error argument you raised as well. If there is no judgment, then Judge Mulrooney can't find that we were a prevailing party. If there was a judgment, if judgment is entered in favor of H&HIG or HIA and Laurel Heppner, HIA.
What was the amount you asked for?
What's that?
What was the amount you asked for costs and disbursement?
I can't recall the amount, but there were a lot of depositions, there were a lot of motion fees. These individuals, Mr. Heppner, was added to the litigation later, so he wasn't even an initial participant in the litigation. But if judgment is entered in his favor, and it should be, it's not just a how did the jury do the math, it's that someone came in and asked for $2.6 million, actually more like over three, against an individual. That individual went to a jury trial, and the jury awarded zero. That's not a, like, maybe they intended to find for against him. That is an element of every one of the claims that was asserted. When you get zero damages, it's basic law school math that if you have an element of a claim, duty, breach, cause, and damages, and the damages issue comes out as zero, then that gets entered as a judgment in favor of the prevailing party, which would be the defendant in that instance. With regard to this discussion that the verdict is binding on the court, we agree it is binding on the court as to the facts. But when the court looks at those facts, looks at Minnesota law, it has to apply the law and can't just accept what the jury has done and then not follow through on its obligation to enter judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments today. We will issue an opinion in the statutory time frame.